This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his resignation Tuesday over allegations he sexually harassed at least 11 women. The three-term governor said his resignation would take effect 14 days after his announcement. His resignation came as the state legislature mounted a campaign to remove him from office by impeachment. Cuomo continues to deny he intentionally disrespected women and said the allegations were politically motivated attacks against him. Cuomo will be replaced by Democratic Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, a former member of Congress. She will be the first woman to serve as New York governor. New York State Attorney General Letitia James said last week that Cuomo's alleged targets were current and former employees of the state government. She said the probe uncovered a, quote, climate of fear created by Cuomo's behavior that included unwanted kisses, groping, hugging, and making unacceptable remarks. She said the investigation also found that the Democratic governor retaliated against at least one former employee for complaining about his actions, and a top aide to Cuomo, Melissa DeRosa, resigned on Sunday. The state attorney general's report found that she had aided the governor's alleged effort to retaliate against one of the women who had accused Cuomo of harassment. Facebook said on Tuesday it had removed a network of accounts from Russia that it linked to a marketing firm which pushed anti-vaccine content about the COVID-19 vaccines. The social media company said it had banned accounts from a Britain-registered, Russian-operated marketing firm for violating its policy against foreign interference. You can find more on that story and all the stories we're covering at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Taliban insurgents tightened their grip on captured Afghan territory on Tuesday, with one European Union official saying they now control 65% of the country. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden urged the nation's leaders to fight for their homeland. A capital in a northern province fell to the Taliban on Tuesday evening, according to residents who reported Afghan security forces retreated toward the desert. It's the seventh regional capital to come under the control of the Islamist militants in about a week. But President Biden says Afghanistan's troops outnumber the Taliban and must want to fight. The U.S. president claims he does not regret his decision to withdraw American troops, noting that Washington has spent more than $1 trillion over 20 years and lost thousands of soldiers in the Afghan war. The Ethiopian government appealed Tuesday for its citizens to join the military to fight the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, in the embattled Tigray region. The appeal from Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's office follows the government's unilateral declaration of a ceasefire in June as its military retreated from Tigray. Representatives of Abiy, the TPLF, and the Tigray Emergency Task Force did not immediately comment. In a statement, Abiy's office said, quote, now is the right time for all capable Ethiopians who are of age to join the defense forces, special forces, and militias to show your patriotism. The TPLF, which ruled Ethiopia for three decades, now controls Tigray. The TPLF-led authority administering the region says it is the Tigray regional government. Ethiopian federal authorities say that government was dissolved and that a provisional administration has the mandate in Tigray. And the U.S. State Department announced Tuesday it is providing more than $50 million in humanitarian aid to citizens of Myanmar. The country is suffering a humanitarian crisis sparked by the February 1st military coup. The coup in the Southeast Asian country, formerly known as Burma, has led to deadly protests against the military government. Clashes have involved several armed ethnic groups fighting against the ruling junta. The violence has forced thousands of people to flee their homes and caused shortages of essential goods such as medical supplies needed to fight what a UN official has called a severe COVID-19 third wave in Myanmar. She said officials have recorded more than 3,600 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday alone, and the number may be higher as testing is not being done across the country. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August the 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. The economy is an issue on the minds of most Zambians as they head to the polls this Thursday.
The tension is so high because of the anticipated competitiveness of the presidential contest between Hakainde Hichilema, the main opposition leader, and the president.
That is VOA's Peter Clody reporting from Zambia's capital, Lusaka. On the National Day of Prayer, Fasting, Repentance, and Reconciliation National Organizing Committee in Zambia has launched a three-day nationwide fasting and prayer period ahead of Thursday's general election. In Rwanda, the government has reduced the price of the COVID-19 rapid test as the country battles the new Delta variant. And a new report says that armed Islamist groups have killed more than 420 civilians and displaced tens of thousands in western Niger since the start of this year.
We documented about 10 attacks that occurred within two regions which border Mali and Burkina Faso.
Corinne Dufka with Human Rights Watch. We have those stories and more right here on Daybreak Africa. And we start off in Zambia, where the National Day of Prayer, Fasting, Repentance, and Reconciliation National Organizing Committee launched a three-day nationwide fasting and prayer period ahead of Thursday's general election. Under the theme, Actualizing Peace and Unity in the Nation, before, during, and after the elections, organizers are calling on supporters of all political parties to refrain from provoking opponents during the campaign period. Dr. Joshua Banda, presiding bishop of the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, the largest denomination in the country, and chairman of the organizing committee, says that as a Christian nation, it is important for citizens to pray for the country's peace and stability during the election process. He says national prayers will be conducted virtually by senior clergy in their respective churches across the Southern African country. For more on the national prayer and fasting period, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Dr. Joshua Banda in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
We believe that from time to time as a nation, there is need for us to come before God and to call for his help. And at this time, when we have an election coming up barely within the next 3 days, we have thought that the best thing the nation can do in the final stretch, the final 3 days, so to say, it is to call upon God for peace.
Does that mean that following recent clashes between supporters of the major parties, is that part of the reason which necessitated this call for national prayer for peace during the election process?
That's not the only reason. It did increase our level of concern, but generally, with or without those kinds of happenings, whenever we are coming towards this kind of activity that is national in nature, we always call for some kind of national prayer. We've done this for the past number of years. The last time we had elections in 2016, we did prayers in May, June, and July.
Has the organization engaged these stakeholders, including the political parties, to encourage them to ensure that their supporters do not engage in acts of violence during this election process?
Yes, that has been an ongoing process for many, many months. We've had chance to meet with a number of the key contenders or their representatives talking about the need to go towards issue-based campaign. From my other organization, which I preside over, which is the Pentecostal Assemblies of God Zambia, the single largest Pentecostal group in the country, we have in fact issued, not only have we issued pastoral letters giving guidance, but we have also engaged in very, very direct conversations with key people, including establishments like the Electoral Commission of Zambia as well, apart from the political players, just so that we are able to not only understand the processes, but also share concerns where we have them. And just last week, we had the very resourceful and meaningful engagement with the Electoral Commission of Zambia. And from that engagement, which was 2 hours long, as the Council of Bishops for the Pentecostal Assemblies of God Zambia, we came out of there with a fairly good level of satisfaction.
That was Dr. Joshua Banda, the presiding bishop of the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, the largest denomination in the country. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty, who is currently in Zambia to cover the elections. And Zambians are getting ready to go to the polls this Thursday to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives in a general election. The two major parties, the ruling PF, led by incumbent President Edgar Lungu, and the opposition UPND, headed by veteran politician Hakainde Hichilema, are both promising to fix the economy, reeling from the impact of COVID-19. Analysts fear that Zambia's position as one of Africa's most stable democracies will be put to test as government deployed the military in mainly opposition strongholds to quell any potential violence between the supporters of the two main parties. Peter Clotty, currently in Lusaka, joins me via Skype to talk about the upcoming election. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. You're currently in Lusaka, Zambia, where you're covering the election, considered one of the most important elections on the continent right now. Let's start off with what is happening. Why does the ruling party feel like it deserves another term? What is their pitch to Zambians on why President Lungu should serve another term?
Their pitch, or the pitch of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, is simple: continuity, because the government is of the view that it has provided a lot of infrastructural projects, highways, among other infrastructure projects that make business easy and make moving from one place to the other very easy. The president just commissioned a terminal built by the Chinese, a new, brand new terminal built by the Chinese right here in the capital, Lusaka. So they are banking on it. The president has also outlined economic policies that he says will jumpstart the economy battered by the global coronavirus pandemic that has affected the economy. So they have outlined some of the policies that they're going to do once he is elected, because they feel that the infrastructure project have been significant and that they've constructed more roads and other infrastructure developments more than even previous administrations since the country gained independence in the mid-1960s.
And speaking of the economy, Zambia's economy has been affected by the pandemic, just like many African countries. I guess issues started well before the pandemic for Zambia. It is the first country in Africa right now to default on their sovereign debt. How much are Zambians talking about the economy as an election issue?
They are talking about it very well, because the opposition's main argument is that they have the men to be better administrators and manage the economy better than the current administration. They accuse the current administration of being unable to solve the myriad of economic and other challenges facing the country. And that is why the president is countering that by telling them, look, I have what it takes. I have these policies. They are yet to bring out any tangible, pragmatic steps. And that some of them are even accusing the opposition leader. They call him the candy man, that he's dishing out candies to everybody, promising everything, yet doesn't have what it takes policies, you know, to actualize these promises. So some of them are, you know, say he's a candy man, dishing out promises here and there that he might not necessarily be able to live up to once he is elected in power. But the president feels confident that Zambians will give him a re-election or voting for a new five-year term.
But the opposition has complained that their candidates are not able to campaign in the same manner as the incumbent, even going as far as, you know, the government apparently deploying security in opposition strongholds. What have you seen in terms of police or army deployment around Lusaka, where you are reporting from right now?
Before I arrived, there were clashes between the government supporters, they call them cadres, and supporters of the UPND alliance, the main opposition party here. Two people died. The UPND claimed one of the guys who died is a leading member of the party right here in the capital, Lusaka. So when I got in, I went to the constituency to check out what was happening, and I saw soldiers right there in parts of Kanyama constituency where the violence occurred. And the president is of the view that the military is needed to beef up security, to help the police to maintain law and order. And according to the Zambian constitution, it is only the president who has the mandate to deploy or tell the military what to do at what time. And in this case, he needs them to help the police beef up security and to restore law and order and ensure that any potential violence is nipped in the bud. However, the opposition is saying that the deployment of the troops, one, shows that the Zambian police has failed or have failed to carry out its mandate to maintain law and order and to protect the property of civilians, unarmed civilians, and that, two, it will intimidate supporters of the party because the Kanyama constituency is known here in Zambia as a stronghold of the opposition party here in the capital, Lusaka.
I know few people who have covered the you know elections in Zambia or politics in Zambia. How is this different this time around?
This time is different because the situation is tensed. People are predicting a 50-50% chance or a toss-up. I heard analysts across Lusaka predicting one group as the president winning re-election and the other that Hakainde Hichilema is going to win. So they are telling me that that is the reason why the tension is so high, because of the anticipated competitiveness of the presidential contest between Hakainde Hichilema, the main opposition leader, and the president. Of course, we also have a televangelist among the presidential candidates. So it's pretty a full course here in Lusaka.
That was VOA's Peter Cloti. I reached him in Zambia's capital, Lusaka. In Rwanda, the government has reduced the price of the COVID-19 rapid test from 10,000 Rwandan francs to 5,000 francs, which is approximately $5. The move comes after many Rwandans complained about the high cost of taking a COVID test. The high cost discouraged many of them from knowing their status as the country is trying to curb the spread of the new Delta variant. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali, Rwanda.
Private clinics across the country have started executing new tariffs for COVID-19 rapid tests. This has increased the number of people who are voluntarily testing for the deadly virus. Jean-Baptiste Mugabo is a Kigali resident. He came here to the test center. He's lucky he tested negative. He says, I work in a hotel. The requirement is that they test after every 2 weeks. At the end of the month, that's a lot of money, seeing how our economy has been affected. By now that the price is at 5,000 Rwandan francs, we'll be taking rapid test happily. The government of Rwanda took the decision to cut half the price of rapid test after a cross-section of Rwandans complained about the high cost of testing. He says the COVID-19 rapid test was very expensive. Sometimes you wanted to test the whole family, but the price becomes a challenge. That's why we claimed so that leaders can look for other ways. She says to voluntarily do the rapid test is very crucial now, especially as we have a Delta variant in our country. The virus can kill you when you didn't see the usual symptoms. When you test, you protect yourself and your neighbors. Gwanda Biomedical Center assures that though the price has been reduced, the quality of the rapid test is guaranteed. Dr. Swai Bigatale is the head of the Biomedical Services Department.
We have validated all the rapid diagnostic test kits that we use in the country. And today I'm happy to announce that all the RDTs that we use comply to the WHO recommendation. And we actually have some that have got a sensitivity of up to 96% and a specificity of 97%.
More than 70% of COVID tests done daily countrywide are taken using rapid test method. Rwanda continues to battle COVID-19 as it was confirmed to have registered cases of Delta variant, which fueled the surge in new infections and death tolls. However, vaccination goes on with the target of reaching 60% of the population vaccinated at the end of next year. Dr. Sabisa Zimana, the Director General of Rwanda Biomedical Center, yesterday announced that the team approved mixing AstraZeneca and Pfizer BioNTech jabs. This will bridge the gap of some Rwandans who got the first dose and missed the second. He says it has been a hot debate subject and many types of research have been conducted. By now, with our researchers, we have proved that a person can mix the two vaccines and don't get negatively affected. Rather, it was approved to more build immune system. Rwanda, which has been recognized for its aggressive public health measures against COVID-19, was recently selected by the African Union as one of the three hubs for vaccine production on the continent. The other countries are Senegal and South Africa. Eugene Uwimana, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Armed Islamist groups have killed more than 420 civilians and displaced tens of thousands in western Niger since the start of this year. That is according to a new report out by Human Rights Watch. HRW's Sahel director Corinne Dufka spoke to VOA's Ricky Shryok about what she heard from local communities about the surge in violence.
There has been a dramatic and disturbing spike in the numbers of civilians killed in western Niger this year. The 420 people who were killed in these attacks all occurred within the context of attacks this year in 2021. We documented about 10 attacks that occurred within two regions which border Mali and Burkina Faso.
Given all of your interviews and you're speaking to people in these communities, did anything emerge as to clearly what might be a reason for this increase? Like, are the groups being enabled? Is the environment just easier for them to carry out the attacks, or is there a clearer purpose in as to why they are carrying out the attacks?
Civilians noted that from about 2019, the relationship started to deteriorate, first with the killing of a number of village chiefs, and then by way of the imposition of increasingly punitive Islamic tax or zakat. But from 2021, they started to really wage war against the civilian population and kill them. So people noted a number of reasons which underscore this dramatic increase. First was the capture or killing by villagers of suspected jihadists. They also noticed the refusal by the population to adhere to the Islam and to support the armed Islamist program. So they refused to give their children as recruits. They also noted the recruitment by the army of hundreds of young men from villages along that border area. So for the jihadists, they blamed people for supporting the army but not supporting them. And then lastly, and this is from security analysts, was an effort by the jihadists to actually push people away from those areas to be able to occupy certain parts of Niger.
What?
Another important dynamic is that some villagers have acquired firearms and are forming local self-defense groups in order to protect their villages, particularly those around the border with Mali, which has been most vulnerable to attack.
If any kind of actions by either the government or the military, do you think look promising, or is it still in a phase where it seems like the authorities are kind of searching for solutions that aren't quite working?
It's an important question. 2021 has been a devastating year for civilians. Most people believe that the killings are the Islamic State, but certainly Jenim or Al-Qaeda linked groups are involved as well, especially in Burkina Faso. In terms of the solutions, you know, it's been quite clear that despite the various different initiatives by the countries themselves and by the international community, they seem unable to adequately protect civilians. I mean, again, the local people recognize that the army can't be everywhere, but they said often they provided intelligence to the army and they hadn't acted on it. And mostly they blame them for not pursuing the armed Islamists.
Corinne Dufka speaking to VOA's Ricky Shryok. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. There has been at least a 20% increase in acts of piracy and armed robbery against ships in the first half of the year 2020. This is according to Maria Luisa Viotti, Chief Cabinet to United Nations Secretary General, who said that threats related to maritime security affect people in every country. As Maureen Ojamba reports, Kenya says that piracy is still a threat to shipping in and out of the country.
According to the report by United Nations, maritime security is being undermined at an alarming pace by challenges around contested boundaries, the depletion of natural resources, and armed attacks ranging from piracy to terrorism. With West Africa, the Straits of Malacca and Singapore, as well as South China Sea, being the most affected by piracy and armed robbery against ships, the UN says the global response must work with people most affected by maritime security challenges. Speaking in a virtual meeting at the United Nations Security Council on Maritime Debate chaired by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta said that piracy is still a threat to shipping and endangers the livelihood of people at the coastal states.
Piracy remains a threat to shipping. Criminal networks are active in piracy, illicit trafficking of persons, firearms, narcotics. In addition, competition and meddling for influence and resources in the region by extra-regional powers has also intensified. This will continue undermining the security of the coastal states and the maritime domain, and indeed the livelihoods of millions of people.
Kenya has earlier been affected by Mata's maritime security. On 25th September the year 2008, the MV Faina ship headed to the port of Kenya was captured by Somali pirates allegedly under the orders of piracy kingpin Mohamed Abdi Hassan. President Kenyatta said that the regional and international approach is key in safeguarding the coastal states and that climate change is also posing as a threat to the people around.
That international cooperation should prioritize equipping and training effective national coast guards, a priority contextualized regional and sub-regional approach, I believe, should be the way to go. It is a reminder that the rising sea levels, as well as the extreme weather conditions, courtesy of climate change, threatens the existence of some small island states and coastal populations.
The world leaders adopted presidential statement outlining their concerns over the increasing frequency of such events. Hasomi Masudu, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs and Cooperation of Niger, said that Africa is paying a heavy price because of criminal acts executed on the high seas.
The African continent pays a heavy price for these criminal acts perpetrated on the high seas, whereas in the first decade of the 21st century, it was the coasts of Somalia and the Gulf of Aden which were the epicenter for diversion of merchant vessels. Maritime security has now grown in size and reached the Gulf of Guinea a decade ago. In this regard, we can already depend on regional and sub-regional mechanisms that already exist, such as the Yaounde architecture established by ECOWAS, ECAS, and the Gulf of Guinea Commission.
The United Nations says the increase of insecurity in the waters in the year 2020 happened despite an overall decrease in the volume of maritime traffic due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Wednesday, August 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Claudy and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them. and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.